This Israel report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
It is 7:44. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your Morning Mayhem. It's 101.9 High FM. Joining us this morning for the Israel Report is Kanani Dor. He's a journalist for JNS. He's a correspondent for High FM. We wanted to, Kanan, good morning to you. Thank you for joining us. I wanted to start with some questions around Denmark. In terms of Jew hatred, what is the latest there?
Good morning, Howard. Yes, Denmark is a bit different from its neighboring countries. It's actually the only Scandinavian country that hasn't recognized a Palestinian state since October 23rd, which already kind of sets the tone. Unfortunately, these two issues are interlinked these days. And it's also a country with very strict immigration laws, although the proportion of Muslim immigrants in Denmark is not very different to what you'd find in other countries. At least they're not taking in new ones. They're not taking in people without screening, as some of the Scandinavian countries did after 2015. When Angela Merkel opened the door. So that's kind of the background. And against this, in 2015, in February, a horrific attack happened in Denmark, in Copenhagen, on the Great Synagogue. An Islamist, a jihadist, came wielding knives and an automatic rifle, killed Dan Uzan, a guard guarding the synagogue while a bat mitzvah party was happening inside. And he was murdered there. Five police officers were injured. It's not very different to other attacks we saw in Europe around that time and even today. But Denmark took it seriously. And a few years later, a very robust plan to combat anti-Semitism happened. And now that plan was complemented with something unique, a research institute headed by a former leader of the Jewish community that will instruct police on how to identify anti-Semitic hate crimes. And the logic behind that is that lots of times these messages are coded. For example, in protests across Europe, you'll hear Chaybar, Chaybar El Yahud, which is a reference to a 8th century massacre perpetrated in Saudi Arabia against Jews. But the average police officer in Denmark, in Germany, in Belgium, when he hears that, it's gibberish to him or her. They don't know what it means. And so you need to have the infrastructure to understand what these codes mean. And that's important because they are a violation of the hate speech laws that exist in Denmark and many other European countries. But other European countries have so far not taken this step of taking experts and making them in charge of providing the legal infrastructure for persecuting these rampant violations of existing laws.
It's just fascinating to watch how each country is dealing with this, if they are. You know, some might not. Some have completely capitulated in terms of Jew hatred. But it is fascinating to see what is going on across different countries in Europe and the war that Europe is actually fighting internally. Because it doesn't appear as though, certainly in Western Europe, that there is a country that isn't dealing with this crisis on one level or another.
Yes, it's very important to set the context here. You know, I spoke to Joël Kotick in Belgium, the head of a local watchdog of the Jewish community, and I asked him to summarize the situation, the legal situation of the Jewish community there. He said, it's open season on us. We have no legal protection. Now, of course, other Belgian Jews dispute this. This is just one Jewish community official, summarizing the situation. But that is not the situation in Denmark. Very few view it this way, with an $18 million budget for this five-year plan that I just mentioned. That includes also education and the new people task forces inside the education ministry to, the more soft approach in contrast to the enforcement aspect that we just discussed. So, yeah, there's very, very stark differences in how these countries approach this dramatic problem.
Mm-hmm. Let's just talk about a dramatic problem, the Gaza Phase 2. I believe that Trump wants to announce this before Christmas, whatever that actually means. What does it mean? What is this likely to look like?
Well, this is phase two of the ceasefire agreement, moving into a reality of a dismantled Hamas and a kind of an independent Palestinian government supported by Western and Arab nations. The only problem is that Hamas isn't dismantled. Only yesterday, four IDF soldiers were wounded when terrorists emerged out of a tunnel in Rafah, in eastern Rafah, in the south of the Gaza Strip, and placed an explosive device on their armored vehicle. So Hamas is still on the ground fighting, and that's the reality. And then you have the plans that Trump is drawing up, and this Axios report about the second phase approaching before Christmas has two important points in it. One is that reportedly Trump told Netanyahu in a phone call that he needs to be a better partner on Gaza, meaning put aside the security interests of Israel and just make this deal happen. This deal that Trump's prestige has so much riding on. And the other point, which is a more positive point from Israel's perspective, is that the Axios report actually mentions that the technocratic government that's going to be in place in Gaza is neither Hamas nor Fatah. Now, obviously, we knew that Hamas wouldn't be in the technocratic government. It's on the ground. We don't need it in government as well. But the fact that, if this report is true, that Fatah is also excluded from the government, that's a big Israeli victory. That's a big Israeli diplomacy achievement. Mm-hmm. Because that's the last thing that Israel wants. It looks at these two entities, Fatah and Hamas, and we discussed this last time, as both equally bad in terms of Israel's security, at least. And so the fact that Netanyahu apparently has achieved this is very significant, but it raises questions, because if it's not Hamas and if it's not Fatah, then that means that those politicians will be isolated and vulnerable. They won't have the backing of an institution in the Palestinian society and the Palestinian politik. And we know how important this structure is in the clan culture of the tribe culture of the Palestinian society. So it raises questions as to their effectivity, their ability to rule.
Right. In terms of the disarming of Hamas, how practical is this?
Well, as Hamas is in the tunnels and not even the IDF is confronting it in an effective way, by effective I mean neutralizing, there's just no other plausible military force that can do this. And so what we're seeing is probably a contract that Trump wants signed that doesn't really reflect reality. It's the appearance of a ceasefire and stabilization of the Gaza Strip, wherein in fact Hamas remains on the ground. And there is growing frustration here in Israel on the right against Netanyahu for allowing this to happen, because of the sacrifices made over the past 2 years in the war against Hamas in the name of an absolute victory, as Netanyahu said. So And that's going to be problematic for Netanyahu, and it's problematic for Trump, because with Hamas on the ground, and we saw this yesterday, it is very unlikely that skirmishes and clashes and events that destabilize the appearance of a ceasefire will stop happening. They will continue.
Yeah, it's and has there been resolution in terms of, you know, we know that Qatar were involved and Turkey, Egypt. There's been a lot of groups, but in terms of the enforcement of this ceasefire, has that been? Do we know if that's been resolved, or is that what's part of this going to be part of this announcement?
The Turkish involvement is a major bone of contention between Trump and Netanyahu, according to reports. Egypt, okay, although they, of course, facilitated and allowed Hamas to arm itself, and still do. Weapon is still being smuggled through by drones, at least from the Gaza Strip to Israel. And where did the arms come from? Well, probably Egypt. So despite this, Egypt is a lesser threat. Turkey is a deal breaker. Netanyahu does not want Erdogan to have feet on the ground in the Gaza Strip. But Trump views Erdogan as a pretty reliable ally in the Middle East. So there's a lot of friction around that. There's friction also in the U.S. administration around that, with people like Mike Durant saying that eventually the Turks will come around, and this is mostly bluster on Israel, the blatant anti-Semitism of President Erdogan, and the others are saying, no, this is a wolf in sheep's clothing, and they will flip on us just like other Islamist regimes have flipped in the past. Take the example of the Persian Shah, how Iran flipped. Turkey will do the same. That's the debate being carried out now in the corridors of power in the U.S.
Let's finally just to talk a little bit more about Eurovision. We spoke with somebody earlier, but I think it's such a fascinating flashpoint because to some extent it is a microcosm of what Europe is dealing with Israel and Jew hatred. I see that the latest information seems to be that Israel will be participating, but certain countries like Ireland, Spain, and the Netherlands, I think, and as well as Slovenia, have decided to boycott. Can you give me your take on what's happening here?
I think it's first important to remember the historic context, and the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post this morning noted that persecution of Jews in the Holocaust started by their cultural isolation. We think of this as kind of a soft issue when Germany stopped the weapons shipments to Israel in August. That grabbed headlines, you know, but the FIFA, the soccer, and the Eurovision, yeah, it's an annoyance. But what Zvika Klein said is, no, this is where it's happening. This is actually the real exclusion. And it's nice to see, to quote Roni Naftani of the Netherlands, a former head of the Jewish community, he said, it's nice to see that the boycotters of Israel, the ones that pushed for its isolation, are now themselves isolated by their positions. But at the same time, the fact that they're isolated allows them to get on a moral high horse and serve as a role model for the other countries. And the people who are representing these countries, these are the broadcasting, the public broadcasting bodies, like the national, like the BBC in the Netherlands, for example. So these are the same bodies that churn out anti-Israel propaganda each evening. So it's consistent from their perspective. But the fact that it didn't work has a lot to do with pressure from inside other participants, namely Germany and Austria, who recognize this reality that Zvika Klein pointed out, that this cultural exclusion is a harbinger for something that Europe cannot tolerate any longer.
What's fascinating is that the Al-Jama'a party, which is a tiny South African political party, but that is often used to further the goals of Jew haters, has put forward what they're calling an apartheid bill. And what the apartheid bill here would mean is that anybody who supports apartheid could be criminally prosecuted. Now, in of itself, that doesn't sound bad. The only problem is that it is very much designed to include Israel and support of Israel, because they claim that Israel is an apartheid state. So what that means as well is any Jew or any Christian or anyone in South Africa who shows any form of support for Israel can be prosecuted. And that, talking about cultural political isolation, is exactly one of those steps where it would mean, you know, Jewish gatherings and cultural events and even religious events, because Israel is very much part of that, would be problematic and would actually could be criminalized. And that's exactly what this goal is. I don't believe that this would it's just a very, very interesting strategy, and one that we need to be aware of here in South Africa as well. Kanani Dora, thank you as always. Wishing you a fantastic weekend. A Shabbat Shalom.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you're based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.